Good evening. It is Thursday, December 19th of 2019. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, House Democrats took the historic step last night of impeaching President Trump, a momentous move that will send long-lasting reverberations throughout the Capitol and the country. Lawmakers voted 230 to 197 on the resolution accusing the president of abusing his power, with all Republicans opposed and only two Democrats, Representatives Colin Peterson from Minnesota and Jefferson Van Drew from New Jersey, crossing the aisle in dissent. Representative Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, a Democratic presidential candidate, voted present. The second article, alleging obstruction, passed along near identical lines, with lawmakers voting 229 to 198, approving it, and Gabbard voting present. Republicans were again unanimous in rejecting the measure, while a third Democrat, Representative Jared Golden from Maine, joined Peterson and Van Drew in opposition. Today, the leaders of the Senate, Majority Leader McConnell and Minority Leader Schumer, took to the Senate floor and explained their positions on how the trial in the Senate should proceed. For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He's a professor of political science at Hamline University and author of Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Professor David Schultz. David, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
First, let me get your thoughts on Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, Democratic presidential candidate. She voted president on both articles. Your thoughts?
She wants it both ways. She wants to still be able to appeal to Democrats in terms of going for the presidential nomination because she's running for president. But at the same time, I think she's trying to cut a different path in terms of disagreeing with where many Democrats are, because she's actually in some ways barely a Democrat on many issues. And so she's really trying to cut it both ways. I know a lot of people have criticized her and said that voting present was really sort of kind of a weaselly thing to do or gutless. She should have taken a stand. But I think she's really trying to play it both ways.
She, in her statement, she said, "I could not in good conscience vote against impeachment because I believe President Trump is guilty of wrongdoing. I also could not in good conscience vote for impeachment because removal of a sitting president must not be the culmination of a partisan process fueled by tribal animosities that have so gravely divided our country. My vote today is a vote for much needed reconciliation and hope that together we can heal our country." Well, you know, one thing I see in her point is something I've been saying for a very long time, is that the Democrats have presented a very good circumstantial case, but they have been lacking hard evidence, and that in the court of public opinion, you need harder evidence than circumstantial. Your thoughts?
I agree. And part of the problem, the reason why they don't have that harder evidence, is that the President of the United States has, obstruction exactly, has refused to let his staff, senior staff such as Bolton, Mulvaney, testify, which is why now the dispute shifts over to the Senate, where the insistence is by Schumer and by Pelosi that these individuals should be called as witnesses so that, in fact, they can allegedly present what they think is the hard and non-circumstantial evidence. And so that's where the battle lines shift to now in terms of what the Senate trial actually is going to look like, and how, really, I was going to say, how the partisan politics, which is dividing this whole process so far, plays itself out in the Senate.
What about Democratic activists such as Charlotte Clymer and Neera Tanden calling Tulsi Gabbard a Russian asset and a traitor?
Yeah, I was going to say that there's a long history of people vilifying people by either calling them, you know, witches, communists, or appealing to some other type of hated group. And this becomes another example here where the Democrats, I think, in many ways, are very, very interested, again, in trying to put up a united front. And for somebody to dissent from that united front, well, obviously they're a traitor. Obviously they have loyalties elsewhere. And I think that's what's going on here, is we're seeing clearly the Democrats, but also I'm going to say the Republicans, are forming very strong partisan tribal boundaries at this point in terms of defining what's the acceptable positions or unacceptable positions for the members of the party to have on the two charges against Donald Trump.
Today, Senate Majority Leader McConnell and Minority Leader Schumer took to the floor of the Senate. And I wanted to get your analysis first of basically McConnell's argument. He laid out the Democrats began impeachment before the president was even nominated. He said it's impeachment in search of articles. Your thoughts on McConnell's argument?
Well, I think McConnell's argument here is the line that I think the Republicans have been setting up for quite a while now, is to say that from square one, from day one, the Democrats have been trying to do an impeachment. And I'm not sure that's completely accurate. It's also not completely inaccurate. There's been a small group of Democrats from almost day one who have wanted to get even with Donald Trump. But at the same time, recall earlier this year when the initial calls came for the Democrats to impeach him, Nancy Pelosi said he's not worth the bother. And she significantly resisted this. And it really wasn't until the revelations of the phone call with the Ukrainian president that I think the circumstances changed, at least for many Democrats. And so I'm not completely sure his comment is accurate, but it is clearly the talking point that I think McConnell and many Republicans are using right now.
And even to that point, even if McConnell is absolutely right that from day one, let's say every Democrat has been trying to find articles of impeachment, that doesn't negate the possibility that these two articles are, in fact, correct. That just means, yeah, you guys have been looking for this since he got here. Well, maybe they finally found it.
And I think that's a good point to make here, is that there were a host of other things. For example, earlier this year, the Mueller report came out, and there were 11 instances in there of possible obstruction of justice, and the Democrats did not proceed with impeachment on that. And the fact there was even discussion leading up to this impeachment proceeding that they might throw in those possible obstruction of justice issues or even violations of what's called the emolument clause. Again, they chose not to do so. So one can come back and make, I think, a credible argument and say that even if they were looking for something to trip up the president of the United States, these two charges might, in fact, be good ones. And the analogy I might use here is the person who speeds up and down the highway all the time and says, well, you never stopped me until now. Or maybe the parallel is to say that I've been driving up and down this highway doing the speed limit all the time, and you stopped me the one time I'm speeding. Well, yeah, well, the one time you're speeding,
you actually
did break the law. You're speeding, so I get to stop you now, yes.
What about McConnell's argument that shifts process is sloppy work, that this has been rushed, and that this has been rigged?
Well, there is a little bit of merit to the argument that it was kind of a partisan process on one level. But on the other hand, I think a lot of that could have been remedied if the Republicans in the House and if Donald Trump and his administration had cooperated. And again, what we're looking at is where the Republicans really refused to go along with any of the investigation. The president refused to cooperate, decided that he wasn't going to send attorneys or provide anybody in terms of defending himself. So at the end of the day, it's going to be kind of hard to completely make that argument from a real process point of view. But again, what reality is and what the talking points are going to be are two different things. And I think the picture that the Republicans want to paint right now is that what the House did with the Democrats, or what the House process for impeachment, was so corrupt, so partisan, that it's now the task of the Republican Senate to straighten it all out.
Before we get to Schumer's rebuttal, McConnell saying that this whole thing is constitutionally incoherent and the president has not been provided due process.
Well, the Constitution only has four clauses that refer to the impeachment process. And given the fact that this process is meant to be a political process, it's not a judicial process, the concept of constitutional due process doesn't apply. And again, going back to a point I made before, given that the president was afforded an opportunity to participate in the impeachment proceedings in the House and chose not to, it's kind of like, what? voluntarily waiving your rights, if you had any, in terms of making claims about due process.
One of the early salient points I think Schumer made in his rebuttal was you heard McConnell and you heard others say that bringing these witnesses, that the president was well within his right to claim privilege. And Schumer made the point, and I'd have to go back and check the record on this, but Schumer made the point the president never actually claimed executive privilege. He claimed absolute immunity, and those two things are not the same.
That's absolutely correct. If it were the issue of executive privilege, the courts have weighed in on the issue of executive privilege, and in situations where there are pending criminal investigations or just in general when there are separation of powers issues, executive privilege sometimes has to give way. But if we're talking about absolute privilege, the Supreme Court has never ruled that an absolute privilege for the president exists. And so there is a tenuous legal argument that the president has been making here in terms of his refusal to cooperate, because at the end of the day, we do have this concept called separation of powers and checks and balances, and the courts have ruled that presidential power is subject to limits. And this is part of, I think, what the impeachment process from the Democrats' point of view is all about. What limits can be imposed upon a U.S. president in terms of the power that he exercises?
What about the inconsistency between then and now? Schumer, during the Clinton impeachment, was saying witnesses should not be called, and McConnell wanted witnesses during the Clinton impeachment. Now, Schumer is calling for witnesses, and McConnell is saying no.
Yeah. No one could ever accuse politicians of being consistent and ever say that they're not, and that they're never hypocrites. You know, this is, and trying to think of all the metaphors, the shoes on the other foot or whatever at this point. No, I mean, both McConnell and Schumer have been guilty oftentimes of hypocrisy and of making arguments in different contexts that are opposite to one another. So I think this is a situation here again that the Democrats would love to be able to have witnesses to come in, and at the same time, the Republicans, I think Schumer especially, not Schumer, I mean McConnell especially, wants this to be a quick process, because I think his fear is that if it were to drag out in the Senate with a lot of witnesses coming in, either this wouldn't bode well for the president or wouldn't bode well for the Republican Senate. So I think he wants it in and out, and that's it.
How does McConnell balance all of the senators who will be jurors in this process have to swear another oath? One of the elements of that oath is to be impartial. And McConnell has already made it very clear and said, I'm not going to be. How does he square that circle?
He gets to square that because of the fact that the impeachment process and the Senate trial are not reviewable by the Supreme Court. And so there's really no enforcement mechanism short of the voters being able to do anything. So if he says, I'm not going to be impartial, I'm going to just basically, you know, we're going to acquit the president, the only recourse at this point is for a Democrat probably or some other party person to run against him in Kentucky and beat him, and for the Democrats to take back the Senate. So at the end of the day, at least in the United States, the ultimate check on statements like that isn't, unfortunately, through the court system, but it's through the political process.
Final question, because you're so generous with your time, and I know your time is short. Last night at a rally, the president in Michigan invokes the name of the late Senator Dingell, and how he even seemed to have expected a quid pro quo from his wife, who took his seat after Dingell passed. I thought that was just totally beyond the pale.
That was very surprising. But then again, the number of times I've been surprised by Donald Trump, who has gone after John McCain after he died, who has picked on parents of deceased war veterans, it doesn't seem to be something that the president reaches a new low. He just seems to be finding ways of continuing to go after people, and at least with his base, they seem to love what he's doing.
Got it. Professor David Schultz, as always, thank you for your time. Really appreciate it. I know your time is short here today. Thank you, as always, for your contribution to the Critical Hour.
No problem. It's always enjoyable to do this.
Thank you.
Bye.
Folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, tonight is the last Democratic presidential debate of the year. After five debates, including at least 10 candidates, tonight's will be among seven Democrats and will be the most intimate affair to date of the 2020 primary. What are we to expect this evening? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. He is the co-host of Nixon and Stranahan, heard here every morning on Radio Sputnik. He is Garland Nixon. Garland, welcome back.
Hey, thanks a lot, Wilmer. Great to come on.
So before we get to the actual debate, let me get your take on Tulsi Gabbard, Democratic presidential candidate. She voted present on both articles of impeachment. Let me read her statement. "I could not in good conscience vote against impeachment because I believe President Trump is guilty of wrongdoing. I also could not in good conscience vote for impeachment because removal of a sitting president must not be the culmination of a partisan process fueled by tribal animosities that have so gravely divided our country. My vote today is a vote for much needed reconciliation and hope that together we can heal our country." Your thoughts on her vote, as well as her being attacked by Democrats such as Charlotte Clymer and Neera Tanden, saying she's indifferent to treason and calling her a Russian operative.
Right. Well, and what's interesting about this, if you go back to the impeachment period for Bill Clinton, at that time, Jerry Nadler made a statement in which he said that he felt that an impeachment that was partisan, where only one party was in favor of it and the other party opposed it, would be illegitimate and would have serious negative repercussions for years to come. So when the shoe was on the other foot, mm-hmm. it was pretty much the position of the Democratic Party. Basically, Tulsi Gabbard's position today was the position of many in the Democratic Party when the shoe was on the other foot. And now there seems to be some level of hypocrisy because, I mean, Jerry Nadler was actually heading a committee during the inquiry. And he's taken an opposite position. So I think it's interesting that a few years go passed by, and Tulsi Gabbard's position was a position of many Democrats a few years ago.
To which I say all the time, you can't vote for political expediency on the front end and then try to claim the moral high ground on the back end. It just doesn't work. Just doesn't work. So to tonight's debate, we have Andrew Yang, Pete Buttigieg, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Amy Klobuchar, and Tom Steyer. Your thought, first of all, on tonight's lineup.
Well, I've been wondering, even though it was only a few days back, ever since the British election, and I watched this gigantic media onslaught. I mean, this giant media attack on Jeremy Corbyn. To be honest with you, I'm expecting the same thing here with Bernie Sanders. So, to me, one of the things I'm looking for tonight, Tulsi's not there, is how the questions and how the tone of this thing goes. And do we see the beginning of, what is going to be, a broad series of establishment attacks on Bernie Sanders? I expect that to start soon. For them to take some kind of a specific angle, anti-Semitism, whatever it is, maybe a bit more difficult to do that with a Jewish candidate, but that's not to say that they won't. So that's one of the things I'm looking out for. Does the political machine pick up the baton from those who attacked Jeremy Corbyn and try to bring that, across the Atlantic here?
One of the elements of evidence of that I have noticed is, you've got Biden, according to the latest CNN poll, you've got Biden at 26, you got Bernie at 20, and Elizabeth Warren at 16. And what I've heard is this lumping still of Biden, Bernie, and Warren in one group. They'll say Biden is leading and Bernie and Elizabeth are right there behind him. Well, no, 26 to 16, that's a 10-point gap. I don't know that I'd put Elizabeth Warren in the same category as Bernie, and the fact that depending on the poll that you look at, Bernie is leading. I've even predicted that Bernie will win Iowa.
Yeah, I'm predicting a lot of wins for Bernie Sanders early. You know, let's not forget that Hillary Clinton led, even at the end, she led Donald Trump. In the national polls, we've seen time and time again, the national polls don't mean a lot. Particularly in the primaries, because in the primaries, momentum is of the utmost importance.
Yes.
If a candidate, we've seen many candidates start off and get a, you know, that were projected to do very well and take a couple losses early, they're out. In the same way, in the Democratic or in the primaries period, say 2 to 3 wins in a row can turn, you know, can create an air of inevitability. That's what I'm trying to get at in the primaries, that if a little bit of momentum turns into an air of inevitability and anyone can, you know, can get momentum. So, you know, I think we need to ignore the really, I'll put it like this. Ignore the polls of, number one, the primaries that are later and the national polls, and focus on the first, say, 5 states or the states leading up to the Super Tuesday. If you take a lot of losses in those, which it's projected that Joe Biden will, you probably can't win in the long run, history tells us.
In fact, that takes me back to the George W. Bush, John McCain campaign, where I want to say McCain won Iowa and then he went on to win New Hampshire. And going into South Carolina, George Bush ran that ad showing John McCain's dark-skinned adopted daughter. And the inference in the ad was John McCain had an extramarital affair with a black woman producing this child. And that, many believe, helped to turn the tide against John McCain in South Carolina. And when McCain approached Bush very angrily about that ad, Bush just looked at him and said, hey, man, this is politics.
Exactly. Well, you know, South Carolina is something we've really got to watch with the Democrats also, because the Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton, the more establishment mainstream Democrats, you know, they need a big victory. They need to the black people in the South to pull them away.
Right.
The last time I checked, and this is an important number, the last time I checked, the lead in South Carolina, Biden over Sanders, had dropped to single digits. It was like 7%.
You are correct, sir.
Joe Biden only wins by 7%. You know, it's kind of one of those things where people talk about a state that's traditionally red or blue. For instance, when you could see in 2016, if the Democrats lost Pennsylvania, say, you knew they were done because that was too important a state,
right,
and that was supposed to be blue. And we can look at the same thing with the establishment Democrats versus the, say, the outsider. If the establishment Democrat doesn't win South Carolina by a significant amount, overall, they're probably not going to do very well. The other thing, let me add this about that, too. That's really bad for the party for this reason. If someone in the primaries wins the states that they're guaranteed to lose during the general election, the southern states, it doesn't, you know, if you run the person that wins the southern states but loses the Michigans and the Wisconsins
and the Pennsylvanias,
then you're probably going to, you know, the probability that you will lose the general election goes up. I think the Democrats are making a mistake. You need to look towards nominate the person that wins the states that you need to win to win the general election.
And so I think to your point about Bernie in South Carolina, a single digit loss for Bernie in South Carolina could be where a Pyrrhic victory actually does matter.
Exactly. That's the point I'm getting.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie doesn't need to win South Carolina. He just needs to come close. If he stays in single digits, I think he wins the whole thing. Right now, I'm predicting a win for Sanders anyway, right now. I'm predicting a broad win for Sanders. A pretty broad win, because, you know, I mean, if you look at it, if I didn't even know the names of it, and you said, well, who's going to win? And I said, okay, well, who's got the most volunteers and who's got the most money? And you said, candidate X, I'd say, well, first of all, before I know anything else, I'm betting on candidate X. Well, that's Bernie Sanders. He's got the volunteers and the most money. But then there are other things. He's got the momentum. He's got so many things.
Right.
But if you just start with the traditional indicators of money and 25,000 volunteers on the ground in Iowa alone, I'm telling you, that man's winning Iowa.
What about the whole discussion now about tonight's panel not being, quote unquote, dark enough?
Well, I think that, you know, as we've seen time and time again, identity politics are simply an argument of convenience. It's an ad hoc argument for the Democratic Party because they tell us we must support, you know, let's look for a woman of color. And then we say, well, what about Tulsi Gabbard? She doesn't count. She's a Russian bot. You know what I mean? Well, they don't mention it. Bernie Sanders would theoretically, he would not theoretically, in practical application, he'd be the first Jewish president, you know, but that doesn't count. So in reality, this ad hoc argument of identity politics is used when it benefits them. Personally, I ignore it. And I always say this about myself. Who would I rather have? Would I rather have a candidate that doesn't look like me, that espouses my policies and will fight for my policies, or one that looks like me, that will go against what I believe in? I'm sorry. You know, I think the answer, you know, is obvious in that one.
Well, and also I would say the standards that the Democrats set for participation are the standards that they set, and they were working fine for Kamala Harris 6 months ago. She was happy as a clam when she raised more money in a day than any other candidate had. She wasn't talking about diversity in the process at that point. Cory Booker was there. It's just a matter of you couldn't sustain your campaign. And primarily, Senator Harris, you couldn't sustain your campaign because you were trying to create a persona that your record didn't match. Senator Booker, you're having trouble sustaining your campaign because you're boring and because you're a corporatist, just like Barack Obama is a corporatist. So your politics suck. It's not that there's a problem with the process.
Exactly. And the other thing is this, okay, you don't like where we've gone to. Some of the candidates have fallen aside. Some white candidates, some black candidates, some male, some female.
It's called attrition. It's called the process of attrition.
Right. And your argument is with the voters at this point. Their problem is with the voters. The voters decided they didn't like Kamala Harris, or they did like candidate X. So if your problem is with whoever is deciding which candidates fall aside, well, your problem is with the voters. So, you know, make their argument to the voters, which they are. So it's not that they don't like what's happening. It's that once again, we see a party that refuses to accept that the voters have a right to choose who they want to. This is the democratic process as set forth. Even though they're not being completely fair now, the party is still not being completely fair with its candidates and above board. But regardless of that, regardless of that, the voters, they're deciding who they like. So, you know, if they want to file a discrimination claim against the voters of the Democratic Party, see how that works out.
And as we get out here on this, I'll just say, is there racism in the process? Absolutely. But is this evidence of that? I say not. Garland Nixon, co-host of Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan, heard here every day on Radio Sputnik. As always, man, thank you for your time. Thank you for your analysis. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you very much, Dr. Leon. Great to come on.
Take care, man. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, as we mentioned at the top of the show, House Democrats took the historic step last night of impeaching President Trump. Today, the House of Representatives will vote on Trump's revised North American Free Trade Agreement, or the USMCA, with House members expected to advance Trump's foremost legislative priority. Does this really demonstrate how schizophrenic the House is? For insight into this, we turn to a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California. He's the author of the new book and very, very good book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, as always, welcome back.
Good day.
So if passed, and it is expected today that it will, Trump's trade deal would move one step closer to ratification after more than a year of negotiations between his administration and House Democrats. Jack, does this, as I said in the opening, confirm how schizophrenic the House is, or is it further evidence that when it comes down to substantive policy, especially looking out for the interests of corporations and elites, there's not much daylight between the two parties? Your thoughts?
My answer in brief would be yes and yes, both your points. Obviously that the USMCA is tied in indirectly with the impeachment, because Trump has been saying, oh, the impeachment process is not getting anything done. Well, the Democrats want to show that it is getting something done. So, they approve the very, very visible USMCA deal and throw it over the transom to him and say, see, you're wrong. So, there's some tactical relationship between the two. But your second point is right, too. It wasn't very hard for the Democrats to agree to it. Just some token labor rules were injected. And we can talk about the content of that. But it's really not very much. In fact, a number of manufacturing union leaders have come out. I think the Machinist Union said, look, this is a big farce. These changes don't protect labor at all. And everyone's lost sight of the fact that Trump promised to bring jobs back, but there's nothing in this deal that will bring jobs back. The trade deficit, $1.2 trillion trade, and the trade deficits will not change. So no jobs are coming back from this. And all this phony talk about labor protections, if you read, behind the lines here, you can see it's mostly token adjustments to sell the deal.
You mentioned trade deficits. Are trade deficits really as important as the president makes them out to be?
It means that money is flowing out of the U.S. The U.S. has these agreements with all these countries around the world to recycle those dollars back to the U.S., because if they don't recycle it back, the U.S. can't fund its budget deficit, which now is well over $1 trillion. Just last month, I think it was $209 billion in deficit, budget deficit now. So this twin deficits, the trade deficit actually is used to fund the budget deficit shortfall, which enables Congress to up defense spending and cut taxes on businesses and investors. So the deficits are important because it allows the ripoffs in domestic policy to continue. That's why you're not going to see much change in this trade war as far as deficits are concerned.
So if through that deficit spending, we got infrastructure taken care of, if teachers' salaries were increased, if we could get clean drinking water in Flint, Michigan, or in Newark, New Jersey, then the trade imbalance, the trade deficit would make a whole lot more sense in terms of financing infrastructure and social programs instead of just being a Ponzi scheme for the military-industrial complex.
Yes, if the money coming back were used for infrastructure and job creation, that would boost the U.S. economy, would create jobs. But because it isn't being used for that, what we got is a net loss of jobs. As I said, in this USMCA deal, the 3 to 5 million jobs lost under the old NAFTA 1.0, there's no change in that. In fact, the loss will probably continue. As far as jobs are concerned, it's a real loser. The deal, the old NAFTA and the new NAFTA, doesn't change that. All it does is allow some cover on, we're going to improve Mexican labor laws, make them more like the U.S., right? And we're going to have labor panels in Mexico and U.S. To rule on violations of these changes on the labor side in the agreement? Joint panels, Mexican-U.S., right? And no labor inspectors until the joint panel says it's okay to bring in inspectors. You see, the original position was, well, inspectors should be able to go in independently, unannounced, into these Mexican factories to see that they're actually paying the wages they say they are, and the conditions are what they say they are, and they're allowing unionization. But if you don't have inspectors going in unannounced, having labor panels to discuss whether they should send inspectors is just nonsense. It's just a cover. It allows them to spin it, you know, in the media and the press that, oh, we got some protections here, and, oh, they're going to raise their wages in Mexico in their factories to $16 an hour. Well, if you read the fine print, they've got 5 years to do that, and they only have to raise it to 40% of the workforce. Well, the market forces are going to raise those wages in 5 years to $16 an hour anyway, so they haven't gotten anything. As far as the labor panels, the labor inspection, raising wages, actually bringing jobs back, there's none of that.
So, 2 points there. First, Trump repeatedly berated the 1994 NAFTA agreement, the North American Free Trade Agreement, as you just talked about, as our country's worst trade deal. But the deal, for the most part, keeps NAFTA intact. Two things. One, isn't what now being heralded as the USMCA, isn't that really just the natural update of NAFTA that had to take place over time anyway? And the second part of that is, this morning, Nancy Pelosi was talking about USMCA and saying, we got enforcement. We got enforcement. We were not going to let this come through unless we got enforcement. And everybody stood there with their eyes all aglaze as though she was actually making a valid point.
Well, you know, that's related to the comment I just made.
There you go. That's why I wanted you to speak to it.
Right. The actual agreement calls for labor panels, joint labor panels between Mexico and the U.S., the actual document, the agreement. And the Mexicans agreed with that because they know that labor panels are a way of deflecting any real inspection and adherence to the changes. But then it came out, it leaked last week that, oh, well, you know, maybe there are inspectors. And Mexico got upset and said, we're not going to agree to that deal if you actually have real inspectors unannounced coming into our factories. Well, that labor inspector provision was in a side letter called an annex to the agreement, not into the main document. The main document calls for the labor panels, but the annex letter calls for inspectors. Well, they resolved the difference. The U.S. has tentatively agreed that, okay, we're going to have labor inspectors. Well, they call them labor attachés, you see.
Right. We talked about that last week.
Yeah, but they're not going to go in unless the labor panels say so, you know. So Mexico says, oh, okay, we can agree with that. You see, Mexico is and López Obrador are very tentative as far as agreement with the U.S., but they always bend to the U.S. Why is Mexico agreeing to anything? Because the U.S. has been holding over Mexicans' head trade action. If Mexico goes ahead and renationalizes its Pemex oil industry, and López Obrador needs that renationalization in order to get the revenues from Mexican oil once again to fund his other programs. So, you know, Mexico is deferring to the U.S. All along the line on what the U.S. wants, not just on this, but on immigration and so forth, because it wants to renationalize Pemex. But, you know, the U.S. went a little too far. You know, Mexican businesses don't like foreign inspectors coming in their factories. You know, how would U.S. business react to that same
right
possibility? You know, but they have a compromise deal, and that is the attachés will only get involved after the joint panels say, okay, time to get involved, or it's okay to get involved.
So we've spent a lot of time, most of our time, talking about Mexico, but Canada is involved in this deal as well. And one of the highlights or benefits from the deal is it's supposed to open the Canadian dairy market to U.S. farmers. Is that going to stop what we've seen as a rash of farm foreclosures, dairy farm foreclosures in this country? Is that going to do anything as it relates to either the ability of farmers to sell more milk or raise the price of the milk that they sell?
Okay. It's not about milk. The dairy farm agreement by Canada has to do with processed dairy and dairy-like products. It does not have to do with raw milk. American dairy farmers aren't going to be able to, you know, Minnesota, Wisconsin, aren't going to be able to sell any more milk than they were to Canada, because the agreement has to do with processed dairy. In other words, manufactured dairy products.
Butter and cheese. Dairy,
yeah, cheese and some other things, you know, like powdered milk and so forth.
Okay.
It's not raw milk. So the 12,000 farmers that went under, foreclosed last year, most of them dairy farmers, are not getting any breaks here with the Canadian deal. See, the main thing with the Canadian deal was the U.S. had originally proposed toughen the dispute settlement, you know, over trade, when there's a dispute with trade, and that it would have to be done in U.S. courts. Well, Canada got all upset about that. But Trump backed off totally on that, and nothing's really changed in the dispute settlement. If there's a dispute with Mexico, it'll be Mexican courts. In Canada, it'll be in Canadian courts. So Trump totally backed off on that. And as far as autos are concerned, you know, a lot of auto imports from Canada and from Mexico. The deal increases the quota that the number of Canadian cars can be imported in the U.S. So, you know, the Canadians got a good deal. That's why they completely, you know, quickly ruled in favor of it.
I'm glad that you clarified the milk issue, because most of the analysis of this that I read and most of the analysis of this that I heard focused on dairy farmers, milk production, and the impact that NAFTA was going to have on saving the family dairy farm. And I'm glad that you just clarified that that's not the point. We have about 45 seconds left.
Yeah, well, that's the spin. You know, there's a lot of spin behind this. And really, you know, Trump comes in into office. He makes a big deal. He's going to change all these. He's going to throw NAFTA out. He's going to change all these trade deals. But if you look at the record so far, you know, there are a lot of softball agreements, just tweaking and token changes, if any. The South Korean trade deal, Canada, Mexico, they let the Europeans totally off the hook, except for a couple billion dollars of French cheese and wine imports. There's been 3,000 exemptions to the steel aluminum tariffs. You know, this is a big phony trade war, except for China, of course. That's the only one. But the rest of it is phony.
And so long as they don't deal with the importation of scotch, they can do whatever in the world they want to do. I don't care. Dr. Jack Rasmus, man, as always, Jack, thank you so much for your time. Greatly, greatly appreciate it. Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Ousted Bolivian President Evo Morales says transnational corporations and the U.S. government were behind the Bolivia coup. In an interview with Intercept co-founder Glenn Greenwald in Mexico, the longtime democratically elected president of Bolivia claimed that he was under pressure from the U.S. from day one of his presidency to put Washington and American corporations before the Bolivian people. For insight into this, we turn to my next guests. First, he's an activist and freelance writer based in Vancouver, a retired researcher from the University of British Columbia, Canada. He is a Venezuelan Canadian who follows and writes about international relations with a focus on the Americas, and is also the editor of the book Cuba Solidarity in Canada, Five Decades of People-to-People Foreign Relations, Nino Paglicia. Nino, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by former vice president of the Concordia Student Union, Yves Engler. Yves is a Montreal-based activist and author. Yves, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
While faces in the White House may change, the same imperialist policies remain in place, according to Evo Morales. He explained, between Obama, Bush, and Trump, he said, I doubt that there are differences between them, maybe in their form, but at the end of the day, there are no differences between them. They all speak of peace, but none speak of social justice or the independence of states, the dignity or identity of the people. So as far as I see, democracy in America deceives its people into voting, but neither the people nor the government rule. It is the transnational corporations who govern, whether it's the Democrats or Republicans. Nino, your thoughts on President Morales' observations?
Well, I would agree 100%, of course. I mean, like, if we follow the U.S. Foreign policy, particularly in Latin America, we definitely see that kind of trend of interventions in the internal affairs of every country in the region and, of course, of the world. Now, I think we do have to understand that the U.S. foreign policy will never change no matter who is the president. And I think the basic, you know, the simplest way to understand that is that the U.S. government and corporations have are in a symbiotic relationship through their strong lobbies in order to secure markets and ideologies, I would say, and to ensure the exploitation of natural resources. And of course, Evo Morales said it very clearly, the interest of the U.S. in Bolivia is lithium. That's what the U.S. is after. But again, let's remember, there is no difference in foreign policy, no matter who is the president of the United States. And that has been proven many, many times.
In fact, thank you, Nino, because Yves, that also takes me right to the point. Not only is there no change in policy depending on who the president is, there's really no change in policy in terms of what decade you look at, whether you look at how the United States claimed the Sandwich Islands for sugar interests, which we now know as Hawaii, or whether we know what America did as it relates to the best interests of the United Fruit Company in Latin America.
Yeah. I mean, there's clearly a long history of American imperialism, and I think it's slightly overplaying it to say there's no difference. I think if you look at Cuba, Obama made some improvements that the Trump administration is rapidly going in the opposite direction. So I would say it's slightly exaggerated, but the broad outline is it's undoubted that there's a long history of U.S. overthrowing of governments. You don't have to go back very far. I mean, just even recent years, the overthrow of Aristide in Haiti in 2004, the backing of the coup in Honduras in 2009, effort to get rid of Chavez in 2002 in Venezuela, the current effort to get rid of Maduro in Venezuela, obviously the coup in Bolivia. There's a long history of U.S. imperialism in the region and around the world. And, you know, even take a look at Bernie Sanders penned this op-ed a day or two ago about opposing the increase in the military budget, which you know, left-wing sources sort of cited this great op-ed by Bernie Sanders. And considering the political context, of pro-imperial political context, it was a good op-ed. But basically, the whole op-ed discussed how you could use the money put into the military for, you know, domestic programs. There was nothing about what the actual U.S. military does to the rest of the world, i.e., you know, destroys governments, i.e., you know, bombs seven or eight different countries as we speak, i.e., you know, involves itself in stoking moral resentment and terrorism and human rights violations. So even at the kind of best end of the official politics, you know, the only criticism you can have of American militarism is that we should use that money, you know, for more programs domestically, not, you know, what the American military does to the rest of the world.
Nino, I don't want to get off track on talking about Cuba, but I do want to get some clarification on Eve's point about Obama policy as it relates to Cuba. As I understand it, and please, if I'm wrong, please correct me, that President Obama wasn't being benevolent towards Cuba. He was basically balancing the pressures between Euro-Cubans in Florida and how they wanted to keep the pressure on Cuba versus agribusiness and tourism interests in the United States, agribusiness seeing Cuba as a viable market for American pork and beef and chicken products, and the airline industry and the cruise line industry who wanted to open those markets to American interests as well. So to Eve's point, yes, benefits are coming to Cuban people were coming to Cuban people from that process, but it wasn't President Obama being benevolent because he loves Cubans.
Yeah, definitely. And it goes back to what Evo Morales just said, that, you know, that the only difference that we see in foreign policy is on the form, but not in the content and you know, the essence of the relationship. And in fact, that's a very good example. Obama, and in his statements, even at the time back in 2014, he was very clear that, you know, well, we have used a policy that hasn't failed, has never worked. Well, now we're going to use a different strategy. So it was just a change of strategy.
Not a change of policy.
Exactly. But the end result, the regime change in Cuba, there was still a goal of the U.S. foreign policy in Cuba. So that's precisely the kind of differences that we see in U.S. Foreign policy. And, of course, I mean, U.S. foreign policy basically responds to the imperial power and the imperialist goal of dominance. And again, Evo Morales said that. Many people say that. And that's basically the essence of it. So Cuba now is seeing a difference with Trump in relation to Cuba. Well, okay, Trump is being more outspoken, more vocal, more folkloric, if you wish. If you want to be fun, make fun of that. But in the end, there was no change in the essence. So now we're seeing a going back to the sort of the hard core policy against Cuba with Trump. But again, we expecting the same goal of regime change.
Let me just say real quick that this interview with that Glenn Greenwald did in The Intercept, I think, is phenomenal. He writes, while faces in the White House may change, the same imperialist policies remain in place. Morales went on to say, the exiled president revealed that there had been multiple attempts to capture him in the weeks of violence that preceded the November 11th coup. He said that members of his security team had been offered $50,000 each to betray him, and at multiple times, his presidential plane had been diverted by the military in an attempt to take him to an Air Force base where he could be detained. However, each time he had been able to contact his supporters who came out in thousands storming the runway. And he talks about the School of the Americas and how individuals are still being trained by the United States at the School of the Americas. Eve Engler, your thoughts?
Yeah,
Yeah, I mean, there's a very good piece done maybe a week or so after Morales was overthrown that just detailed the connections between the different top police and military officials in Bolivia who were, you know, behind the coup and their relationship to American training, American military service. It's always been a very important part of domination is having good connections with the different militaries, you know, not just in the hemisphere. Obviously, School America is focused mostly on the hemisphere, but around the world, and that's a way of you know, in times of political crisis or in times where there's a real push to get rid of a president or to make a decisive political action, having military officials that are you know, close to you, that maybe you've handed them a little bit of cash on the side, or you just know them and trained them and given them a certain kind of ideological outlook, that becomes very important. And we see that playing out again in this case. And you know, this is why those protests against the School of Americas are so important, that this is there's, you know, pushback within the U.S. against this imperialist policy.
Yves Engler and Nino Paglisia, gentlemen, thank you both so much for your time today. As always, really appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
Folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out!